Walk into any bookstore and chances are you'll find a section filled with books telling you how to be happier in one way or another. But well before the self-help industry emerged, philosophers were asking themselves questions about what was necessary to live the good life. Now, in his latest book called Examined Lives, From Socrates to Nietzsche, James Miller has looked into whether a dozen of these philosophers followed their own advice. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Miller back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
How did you select these 12 philosophers? Did they lead the most interesting lives, or were you just most interested in them? Because I was thinking about some of the ones who didn't make the cut. Spinoza, Hume, Kierkegaard, Schopenhauer, Wittgenstein, Heidegger, Sartre, Foucault. Well, you wrote about Foucault before, but they all had incredible lives.
Oh, they all had incredible lives, and the fact is I could do, you know, more examined lives. But I decided as I worked my way into the project, originally I was just going to write about philosophers who claimed in some level to live their life in accord with their principles. But I decided early on that part of the story I needed to tell was how going all the way back to Aristotle and through Descartes and Kant, philosophy came to be seen as a largely contemplative activity that was pursued through a kind of pure, rigorous inquiry, which is what most people think of philosophy today in terms of academic philosophy. I tried to strike a balance between ancient and modern philosophers, and early on I decided I didn't want to go into the 20th century. I actually had the first essay I wrote working up to the book was on Heidegger, but I left it out because I thought there was a real symmetry to ending with Nietzsche.
Well, Heidegger, partly because his life is so controversial.
Yeah.
Was he or wasn't he a Nazi, for example?
Well, he was a Nazi, period.
The one of the things that does tie most of these people together is that they were fairly eccentric.
Yes. I think going back to Socrates, his eccentricity really jumps out if you contextualize him, because ancient Athens was a society that was still bound together by religious rituals. It was a fairly superstitious society. People took seriously oracles. It was the first democracy, and the expectation was if you were a good citizen, you participated in public affairs. You didn't wander around the streets asking people what they believed. That was a very eccentric thing to do, which is, I think, why Aristophanes could have comic sport with Socrates.
Socrates' ambition was to live the life of a philosopher, to examine myself and others.
Yes.
But how much do we really know about Socrates? Isn't our main source of information Plato, who used Socrates as just a mouthpiece for his own ideas?
Well, first of all, Plato is the main source for our information about Socrates, supplemented by Xenophon, of which there are three complete dialogues that are about Socrates by Xenophon. They're fragments from other people.
Alcibiades.
What's fascinating that I didn't expect in the book is that what may be the earliest examples of autobiography and biography in the West have to do with philosophers. And Plato's dialogues were understood, for example, by Aristotle to be a new genre. But for Aristotle, it combined fact and fiction. It was a form of poetry. So for the first part of my book, I'm having to sort of recount, because everybody told these stories for thousands of years, these legends and myths that grew up around the early philosophers, so that the status of this information is, I suppose, analogous to what we do and don't know about Jesus Christ.
Well, the legends and myths are both positive and negative.
Yes.
Sometimes meant to show them as rather foolish people at the same time that they were brilliant.
Yes. Well, I think one of the most interesting of the ancient philosophers is Diogenes the Cynic, who lived in a tub. He wandered around in broad daylight with a lamp saying, "I am looking for a man." Talk about eccentricity. He also was alleged to have disrespected Alexander the Great, who came to visit him in his tub where he lived. And Diogenes said, "Please get out of my way. You're standing in the sunlight." And yet he was beloved in antiquity, and statues were erected. He was never put on trial.
But he was also the source of what we know about other philosophers. Wasn't he? He wrote The Lives of the Eminent Philosophers.
There are two Diogenes.
Oh, that's the other guy.
Diogenes the Cynic is not the same as Diogenes Laertius, who lived later and wrote this large compilation of anecdotes and doctrines called The Lives of the Eminent Philosophers.
And which one was Nietzsche the big admirer of?
Well, Nietzsche knew of both of these Diogenes, but Nietzsche wrote his doctoral dissertation on Diogenes Laertius, the author of the compilation of The Lives of the Philosophers. So did Karl Marx write a dissertation on the same.
And what was his appeal for them?
Well, for Marx, the appeal was that Diogenes Laertius has a huge chapter on Epicurus, who's the first materialist philosopher. So Marx, as a young aspiring materialist, that's what he gravitated towards. This, I think, for Nietzsche, he, as a Protestant, as a son of a Lutheran minister, the notion of exemplary lives that one could learn something from, not just the doctrines, but looking at the lives they actually lived, appealed to him.
Well, did you find that most of these people lived according to their principles, or did they preach one thing and do something else?
Well, the interesting thing is, if you're dealing with legends, how would we ever know? I mean, if we look at Socrates, I sometimes say to students in the Symposium of Plato, Plato depicts this night of hard drinking, and Socrates could drink all kinds of alcohol and never get drunk. And Alcibiades, who was this up-and-coming young statesman who was very beautiful, wanted to sleep with Socrates, and they go to bed together. But then Alcibiades said, and I woke up and he hadn't touched me. This is the origin of the notion of platonic love. But I say to my students, well, what if it turned out he actually had gone to bed with him? How would we reassess? How do we really know if Socrates didn't weep or whimper when he drank the hemlock? So what certainly happens as we move forward and we get to have more and more sources, Seneca, we know from Tacitus and other historians of Rome, how he behaved, we find more and more discrepancies in how people behave under duress than how they promise to behave.
My guest is James Miller, professor of politics and the director of liberal studies at the New School for Social Research, author of The Passion of Michel Foucault, and Flowers in the Dustbin, The Rise of Rock and Roll, which is a very different area of inquiry. And that's the one that brought you to our show 10 years ago, is
that
right?
Yeah, that's right.
The latest book is Examined Lives from Socrates to Nietzsche, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. You point out that until fairly recently, people were required to read these philosophers, especially the ancient ones, in their original languages, which meant knowing Greek and Latin.
Yes.
So does that mean that people knew more about them as people at that time?
I think there's no doubt that they knew more about these legends, which have basically gone out of circulation in the last 100 years. And one of the things I discovered in writing the book, which is I was trained in part as a political philosopher, came as a surprise to me, is that the telling of stories about philosophers in their interactions with statesmen and tyrants was a very important part of the curriculum for the ruling class, or the people you were training to assume power and governance. And from the Renaissance up until the Victorian period, these stories were very well known.
Well, philosophers have had relationships with the powerful. Aristotle with Alexander the Great, Seneca with Nero.
Yes.
He has to be tainted by that, especially since both of them, because they did all sorts of things that weren't all that admirable because they were working for these people.
Well, there's controversy about this, particularly let's just take the case of Seneca and Nero. In antiquity, somebody like the historian Tacitus praises Seneca as Nero's tutor, because he argues that Seneca was able to restrain Nero for 4 or 5 years of his early rule. These were known as the 4 or 5 good years. And one of the recurrent tropes in this literature is the way that a philosopher who is both sort of an educator, a PR guy, a speechwriter, the hope is that their good character will inhibit what otherwise would just be nihilistic lust for power.
And not just for power. Wasn't Seneca given the task of distracting Nero from his mother, who was trying to seduce her son?
Yeah, well, you know, the mom was trying to seduce Nero, so Seneca was obtaining young women. Maybe he would have been good with Berlusconi, you know.
He also wrote a lot about how to approach death. Did that help him when Nero ordered him to kill himself?
Well, again, there are two versions of this. One of them, one historian says, well, actually, he whimpered. He was not, you know, he betrayed emotion. As a professed Stoic, one of the highest aims of the way of life that Seneca tried to embody was that you wouldn't succumb to grief or fear. So if you were to cry, that would be a terrible thing that you would have done. On the other hand, Tacitus says he was a cool customer, and he just slit his veins and sat there in a tub of steamy water. And most of the iconography, which you can get all the way through up till the 18th century, he looks like he's sort of almost as cool as Socrates.
Well, how relevant are Socrates and Aristotle really influenced much of the thinking that followed? How influential was Seneca? Did he have any ideas that seem relevant today?
Well, Seneca, you know, as an intellectual historian, it's easy to show that he was very influential on the early church fathers because he wrote in Latin on Augustine. He was influential in the Renaissance on Jean-Jacques Rousseau. But that's not the kind of question you have in mind. I think you're asking me about, you know, does this matter in 2011?
Because we do read these philosophers to gain some, in the same way we read great novelists, to gain some insight into human psychology and ourselves and the way the world works.
Well, I guess the answer I would give is that almost everybody in my book contributed in one way or another to a kind of normative culture that takes for granted that the examined life is not worth living and that some degree of introspection and critical reflection on what we believe is a good thing to train people to do. And I would maintain that's not a self-evident good thing to do. And it may well be that Nietzsche said this in one of his, you know, paradoxical quips that people, you know, better ignorance than knowledge, because if you want happiness, maybe you should make yourself oblivious to these kinds of cognitive issues.
What about Aristotle, who was connected to Alexander the Great? Can you see the influence of Macedonian power on his work?
Well, no, actually, I think is the question, is the answer to that question. Because, you know, the treatises are Aristotle's sort of the first person to make his philosophy kind of impersonal in a very deliberate way. So in writing my chapter, what happens is that the stories that are told about his life suggest real discrepancies with what you read in the written work. But if all you read was the books, you wouldn't have any clue that he had been connected in this way to Alexander.
He had rivals who spread rumors that he had poisoned Alexander the Great and sold drugs.
Well, his father apparently was a doctor, and doctors in those days, you know, had drugs. And I guess even in those days, they knew that drugs could make you happy too.
James Miller's book, Examined Lives from Socrates to Nietzsche, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and congratulations on all the great reviews it's received. We'll come back and talk about some more of the philosophers after a little break. Stay with us. My guest is James Miller, whose latest book is Examined Lives from Socrates to Nietzsche, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. You suggest that the modern era in philosophy begins with Montaigne in the 16th century. I've always thought of him as the father of the modern personal essay. At least that's what my brother has written more than once. Is he generally thought of as a philosopher?
Well, that's an interesting question. Certainly at the time that he wrote his essays, he was received as a philosopher. And in France, for the next 200, 300 years, he was received as a philosopher. But one of the things that happens after Montaigne writes is there is a growing bifurcation between an older form of philosophy that sees its main task as self-examination and reflection on the best form of life and philosophy that's construed rather as a very as precise an account as possible of the way the world really is, taking into account the latest findings of what we today would call natural science. You can see both of these aspects of philosophy still in a kind of equipoise in Descartes, but after Descartes, they just split apart.
So, well, I remember in philosophy class being told that philosophy was the source of any number of sciences that followed logic, for example, psychology. So is it what happens? Are these things seen as the natural areas of interest for philosophers until they become too complicated for philosophers to consider, and then they have to be
that's a very
become
good
a
way
specialization?
Of, that's a very good way of putting it because, you know, in some sense, there is everything in Plato and Aristotle. But in the modern period, you find that inquiry becomes more and more specialized and disciplines hive off from philosophy and begin to establish their own criteria for what counts as good research. Psychology is an early example that spins off. Economics spins off from philosophy. Adam Smith was a philosopher who in some sense invents modern economics. Sociology spins off often from philosophy. So that what you have is the rise of more and more rigorous specialties that evolve in a language that's no longer accessible to ordinary people. Meanwhile, you have this other tradition of philosophy that's more belletristic that grows out of Montaigne, in which the essay remains a kind of central mode of communication.
And in the case of Nietzsche, even more just writing a novel. I don't know what Thus Spoke Zarathustra really is, but...
Well, it's kind of a parody of the New Testament. Mm-hmm. One of the jokes to me is that many modern-day Nietzscheans, since they've never read the New Testament, don't understand how much of it's riffing on the Synoptic Gospels. So that Zarathustra is a kind of holy fool who, you know, goes through some of the paces that Jesus did, but talking to animals instead of disciples.
What about Nietzsche? He seems to me to be one of the most misunderstood philosophers of all time, associated with Nazism in many people's minds. But in my readings of his work, he struck me as someone who would have found Hitler an abomination.
Well, I'm sure he would have found Hitler an abomination, but the misunderstandings are partially his own fault because he deliberately chose to write in a way that's radically open to different forms of interpretation, different responses from readers. So did Montaigne, for example. That's what makes Nietzsche as much a literary figure and endlessly interesting, rather than somebody who just gives you a series of propositions that is laid out in as dry as dust format that doesn't, you know, sort of excite the imagination. But once you get excitable imaginations, we're off to the races.
But he's also someone who points the way to existentialism. One of the pioneers of existentialism, isn't he?
Well, yes, and I think that existentialism itself as a phenomena straddles some of this idea of rigorous inquiry because of its references to Husserl and to some extent Heidegger. But Sartre really clearly, I think, you can do a pretty straight genealogy tracing him back to Montaigne as a belles-lettres writer at his best, actually.
In the case of Nietzsche, we tend to think of him as also this dark, stormy figure. But you point out that he seems to have kept a very clean apartment that was decorated with flowers.
Well, I mean, the pathos of Nietzsche, which I didn't completely understand until I was working on the book, is that he was really a sick person. And syphilis was a disease that went through many phases. And he also lived, he grew up knowing that his father had died when he was 5 years old of a brain ailment or of a weakness of the brain. So he was obsessed with mental illness and the possibility that he himself was mad. That was not a kind of romantic flourish. It was something that haunted him. I think it's a very sad story, actually.
Because he was perhaps the last of the truly great philosophers, don't you think?
No, because
you
know,
you like Sartre.
Well, I also wrote a whole book on Michel Foucault, who I'm fond of, and I studied and I greatly admired the work of Wittgenstein and Heidegger. So there are plenty of 20th century philosophers that I could have perhaps carried this forward, but there's only so much you can do in a book that is you can read and hold in your lap.
Well, in this book, a lot of what you write about is the contradictions in these people's philosophies and lives. Immanuel Kant preached reason, but he was convinced that there was life on other planets, and he theorized that the beings that lived in Jupiter and Saturn had cognitive capacity superior to ours. How did he come up with that?
Well, I can't tell you how he came up with
that. He had no proof, did he?
No.
He was also a hypochondriac.
Well, he was a hypochondriac, and that it's the only thing autobiographically he writes about. And he says, I have a mental illness. I'm a hypochondriac. I think that cultivates acute self-consciousness, that actually it's almost inevitable that one will become aware of many contradictions and gaps between ideals and one's natural self as it unfolds often to one's horror. Then the question becomes, is it useful to be hyperconscious of the gap between the ideal and the reality?
Well, we have Rene Descartes, who says, I think, therefore I am, and then he's worried about actual demons deceiving him in his dreams.
Well, here's a problem. If you're a philosopher who believes in revelation, Plato does, I think Descartes does, a number of my figures believe that they might be privy to visions that you can't give a completely rational defense of, then the question becomes rather important. How do you evaluate these visions? And if you grow up in the Christian tradition, Augustine in The City of God actually has several subsections talking about how you distinguish between good angels and bad angels. Bad angels are demons and emissaries of the devil. So, you know, for 2,000 years, this was a rather normal way of thinking.
Although Augustine starts off much more of a rationalist, later becomes much more of a mystic, doesn't he?
And
a lot of this is about how people evolve.
It is, but I think to take the example of Plato, and this would be true of Augustine, Plato, I think, shows that, you know, mysticism and high rationalism don't necessarily fall apart. They can go together.
In writing this book, did your ideas about these philosophers change at all?
Oh, absolutely.
Were any of them disappointments to you?
No, I don't think it would be quite right to say that I would be disappointed. I think, for example, Kant is sad. Many of the amusing anecdotes about Kant, which one could take out of my book, come from his dotage. I mean, he basically lived a long life, long enough to suffer from senile dementia. He's the first person in my book that we have, you know, documentation of that sad state. So I felt sort of pity for him. But as I say, there were lots of other Nietzsche I just didn't expect to see and feel quite the pathos I feel when I think of him now. That came out in the book.
Kant died a virgin. I don't know whether that's important to know, but a number of philosophers did, it seems, because they lived such reclusive lives.
Well, some philosophers thought that the body contaminated the soul, the mind, the spirit, which is what one wanted to cultivate.
James Miller will be on a panel moderated by Lewis Lapham tonight at 7 o'clock about whether philosophy still matters. That's at the New School's Tishman Auditorium at 22 West 12th Street. For more information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, Examine Lives from Socrates to Nietzsche, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
On tomorrow's show, environmental reporter Mark Hertzgaard explains what climate change will make the next 50 years look like, from a Chicago that's as hot as Houston to a New York City that's underwater. And then Chloe G.K. Atkins tells her story of contracting a mysterious illness, only to be told by doctors that her paralysis was psychosomatic and that she was willing her own death. Also, Jennifer Carpenter and Pablo Schreiber discuss their roles in Rajiv Joseph's play, Gruesome Playground Injuries, and our latest underreported segments. Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Jessica Miller, Max Bass, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.